This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Joel Hilliker. Some exciting stuff on today's program, including a conversation about a new project being launched by the Trumpet's editor-in-chief and founder of Trumpet Radio, Gerald Flurry. We'll start the program with that, so I'll tell you about it in just a moment. But we will also hear today about the strongman of Hungary, Viktor Orban. Many European leaders are following a left-leaning, technocratic model of leadership, and this has a lot of European voters dissatisfied. Not so in Hungary, where the prime minister is leading as a very popular strongman. He's been making some bold moves in recent weeks that are getting some European leaders ticked off. But Bible prophecy shows we can expect to see more of the Orban model in European nations in the time ahead. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic about this. We'll also hear a story that will get your dander up. All this money that governments have been printing and throwing around for COVID relief, which is putting many nations, including America, deep into debt. Well, a huge amount of it has been stolen by criminals, tens of billions of dollars. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Urfaro Manyepa about this story. And for the last word on today's show, I'll give you a couple of qualities you can grow in to deepen your friendships. Now, to start today's show, this new project in the realm of biblical archaeology. This is an exciting and important field of science. A lot is being unearthed in recent years, proving the veracity of the Bible as a reliable source of history. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Flurry, has put considerable resources into supporting archaeological activities in Jerusalem that have turned up some spectacular finds. Well, to amplify these activities, Mr. Flurry is starting a brand new project, the Armstrong Mazar Institute of Biblical Archaeology. To talk about this exciting new venture, we have the assistant director of the Institute, Brad McDonald. Hello.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for coming in. So let's start by talking about biblical archaeology generally. It's a relatively new field. What is it exactly? And maybe you could just tell us about the history.
Sure. Well, the term biblical archaeology is somewhat of a loaded term. The definition kind of depends on your view of the Bible. Bible skeptics would say that the biblical archaeologist is more of a theologian than a scientist, that their job with archaeology is to prove the Bible, and that they're kind of motivated, you know, by their love and affection for the Bible. That's what the skeptics say. Scientists or archaeologists who use the Bible, such as Dr. Alat Mazar, she would say, well, no, the Bible is a historical document. It's a scientific document. And when excavating in the land of Israel, how can we practice good science and not consult this historical text? Mm-hmm. So a biblical archaeologist in that regard is someone who will consult this historical text when conducting archaeology.
Biblical archaeology, it's been around really for what, maybe about a century. You've had some pretty prominent people who have specifically been trying to unearth record in the Bible, in the stones of Israel and other places.
That's right. Probably closer to 200 years. The late 1700s, early 1800s is when it really began. And it did begin with religious scientists. Scientists for sure, but men who absolutely believed the Bible, Christians, going into the land of Israel. And their motive, for the most part, was to find the Bible. Mm-hmm. In archaeology. And then 200 years ago, obviously, the science of excavation wasn't nearly as developed and as sophisticated as it is today. So these men were minded to find the Bible in the stones of ancient Israel, and they didn't have great scientific tools at their disposal. So the first biblical archaeologists, they were pretty strong Christians with the goal of proving God and proving the Bible. within about 100 years, particularly as the science developed, but also as just the general topic of biblical skepticism developed, mm-hmm. especially in Germany. Mm-hmm. So by the late 1800s, we really have this school of thinkers who were pretty critical of the Bible, and they start practicing archaeology, and they have better science at their disposal, and then they also have a skepticism toward the Bible. So they start really challenging some of the conclusions that the early biblical archaeologists had made. And in quite a few cases, they did prove wrong some of the assertions of the early biblical archaeologists. But then some of those Bible skeptics, having proved wrong some of the early conclusions, they became overly confident, and then they blamed the wrong conclusions on the use of the Bible, mm-hmm. When it wasn't the use of the Bible that was responsible for those wrong conclusions. It was maybe
some of the methodology,
lack of science, the methodology. So then as we get into the 1900s, we just have a much stronger criticism of the Bible in the field of archaeologists.
Mm-hmm. So what we see maybe in more recent decades is the science has kind of caught up with the field, and you have archaeologists who are using better methodology, and they're really applying, making sure that all of the best practices are in place as they're excavating these. You mentioned Dr. Elat Mazar as being someone who basically just looked at the Bible as, this is an invaluable historical record that we have to consult in order to understand what it is that we're digging up. She didn't even view it really as an inspired text.
Right.
It was just something that you could trust.
Right. She's not religious. She doesn't believe it as an inspired text. Think about an archaeologist excavating ancient Athens. He's going to consult Herodotus or Thucydides. He's going to consult these ancient texts, mm-hmm. and he would be criticized if he didn't conduct his archaeology in the context of these ancient texts. That's really the way Dr. Mazar views it, mm-hmm. and the biblical archaeologists out there, they'll say, well, how can we dig in the land of Israel and not consult the book mm-hmm. that documents the history of the Jewish people?
Yep. So Mr. Fleury has said that the field of biblical archaeology is in a bit of a crisis right now. How is that the case?
Well, it's just biblical archaeology isn't being practiced, and it isn't being taught the way it was 20 or 30 years ago. Hmm. So kind of the heyday of biblical archaeology was maybe 1940, 1950, 1960, 1970s, early 1980s. And then as we get into the mid to late 1980s, we really see kind of the Bible skeptics come out strong. And that's really been the case the last few decades.
Now, those decades that you're talking about, this is when Israel comes into possession,
right,
with the land of their ancestors, and you had men like Benjamin Mazar, who was very, very instrumental in the founding of Israel and archaeology. In a way, it was kind of part and parcel with the identity of this new nation.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. That's how Professor Benjamin Mazar started his dig on the Temple Mount within a few months of the Six-Day War concluding. Mm-hmm. But basically, the state of Israel came to him and said, we now control the Temple Mount. Let's start digging. And that's what he did. And that's what happened all across Israel.
So Elat Mazar, Benjamin Mazar maybe less so, but Elat Mazar certainly encountered quite a lot of resistance from the skeptics that you're describing.
Right.
And if you just look at, say, the academic field and the scientific community generally, and the archaeological community more specifically, there is a fair amount of resistance to that using the Bible as a historical text among some fairly prominent people. This is one of the things that makes the field maybe a bit more challenging today than it would have been maybe a generation ago.
Absolutely. I do think part of it is it's easier, it's more palpable, it's easier on your reputation to be a Bible skeptic, because we just live in a day and age where culturally and intellectually everyone questions the Bible. We're generally just a much more atheist or anti-Bible society. So to question the Bible against that backdrop is pretty easy. To stand up for the Bible against that backdrop requires, you know, some courage. I actually feel that there are a number of archaeologists out there who are open to using the Bible, but it does take a certain bravery to really talk about that publicly and to just to not be afraid to publicize how much you've used the Bible. Dr. Alat Mazar, she was just unapologetically pro-Bible in her archaeology, and that really did chafe many archaeologists and many prominent archaeologists just the wrong way.
Gerald Fleury says we need to provide some support for this field that is a bit under siege in certain circles. He's talked about the fact that he feels like the Jews generally and probably a lot of people even further afield have a real interest in this, but it's like it needs support, it needs a champion. Just talk about this new institute and what the objectives are behind it, what sort of activities it will be involved in.
Sure. Well, first of all, we've been told both by scientists in Israel and even here in America that the kind of those earlier Bible institutes, many of which are still in existence today, are kind of suffering or they're waning. They're not as, let's say, pro-Bible in archaeology as they once were. So that's unfortunate. We've even seen, I feel like we've seen even with Biblical Archaeology Review, this magazine that began, was started by Herschel Shanks, very pro-Bible here in the past few years, is just not nearly as pro-Bible as it began.
When did Shanks die?
He died. He died last year, last year.
Yeah.
And when he stopped being managing editor of the magazine, you know, I think you noticed a drop off. So there's just the institutes, the publications out there aren't as pro Bible as they used to be. Mr. Fleury has noticed that. He's heard that. Dr. Mazar's told us that. So he wants to you know, have an institute, and in Let the Stone Speak, the magazine of the institute, have something that's just unapologetically pro-Bible. So that's what the institute is going to do.
And what ways will the institute use to promote that kind of worldview there?
Sure. So first of all, we have Let the Stone Speak. This is the print magazine of the Armstrong Mazar Institute of Biblical Archaeology. We produce 6 issues a year. After that, we're creating a new website, armstrongmazar.com. That's the institute. That's the website of the institute. On that website, we're going to have publications and scientific reports, articles on, you know, new finds in the world of biblical archaeology. Brent hosts a biblical archaeology podcast.
Brent
Nachtigal hosts a podcast.
And what's his role within the institute?
I mean, it's key. He manages the library. He manages the excavations over there. He's really an interface between the institute and the different organizations in Israel. The institute will sponsor archaeological excavations in Israel, in the City of David and on the Ophel. So visitors will be able to come to the website and follow our excavations. With the institute, we also hope to eventually be able to host some seminars on biblical archaeology. We'd like to continue to produce archaeological exhibits We've done a couple here in America. We'd like to be able to start to produce some archaeological exhibits in Israel, and maybe even traveling exhibits that we could set up, that we could take around Israel. So we have quite a few plans for the Institute.
Well, very exciting. So the name of the Institute, Armstrong Mazar, it highlights this relationship between, you were talking about Benjamin Mazar, Professor Benjamin Mazar, and Herbert W. Armstrong, the namesake of a lot of what we are involved in here, Herbert W. Armstrong College, Armstrong Auditorium. Maybe you could just talk about the relationship there and how those men and even Elat Mazar, I mean, Mazar, her name is in the Institute's name as well, how they embody what we're trying to promote and preserve in this work.
Sure. Well, Herbert Armstrong, the forefather of our work, as you said, in many different ways, I think Mr. Armstrong would absolutely embody our approach to the Bible, our love of the Bible, the place the Bible holds in our life. And then Benjamin Mazar and his granddaughter, Elat Mazar, they would really embody the right approach and our approach to archaeology, which is to practice good quality science, to use all of the technology and methodology available to us to practice good archaeology, but also to use the biblical record in our practice of archaeology. Both Professor Benjamin Mazar and his granddaughter just weren't afraid to consult the biblical text whenever they practiced the science of archaeology, and that's the way we'll be too. We want to consult that biblical text when we practice science.
Talk a little bit more about this magazine, Let the Stone Speak. This is replacing Watch Jerusalem. You've been the managing editor for that magazine for quite some time. Why the change? What can we expect in this new magazine? And is this something that's even available broadly? Could listeners receive a copy?
First of all, it is available broadly, so listeners can, right now you'd have to go to watchjerusalem.co.il to take up a subscription, but here in a week or so you'll be able to visit armstrongmazar.com to establish a subscription. The magazine, the biggest change that's taken place with the change in name is the magazine is now 100% archaeology. For the longest time, or until the most recent issue, the magazine included news events surrounding Israel and some Bible prophecy. But with Let the Stone Speak, the magazine is 100% archaeology. There's no news, there's no prophecy. We're really just sticking with the science. So that'll be the biggest change. And then as the Institute starts engaging in some pretty serious scientific research, we have a couple of projects coming up where we'd like to reevaluate the Isaiah Bulla, for example, or as we continue to help Tali Mazar publish her sister's archaeological findings, those will be published in the magazine.
Mm-hmm. Let the Stones Speak. Why the title?
That was probably Dr. Mazar's most famous statement. Whenever she gave an interview, she almost always would talk about how we had to let the stones speak, or we had to let the science speak. The job of an archaeologist is to take the scientific evidence before them, including the historical text, and interpret the science, develop an understanding, develop a story based on the science provided, in the archaeological finds and by the historical record. So that statement really embodies who Dr. Mazar is and her approach to archaeology, and it embodies the Institute's approach to archaeology as well.
I think it's in Brent's article in this first issue where he was talking about Dr. Mazar saying something to the effect of the stones themselves don't necessarily say a whole lot. They are mute, obviously. You uncover something and you're looking for every clue you can find about it. But this is where, when you bring the Bible into it, then it adds this whole rich dimension to what you're uncovering. And so then you really can get the full story of the Bible in and of itself. You could kind of dismiss that as, well, you know, that's a nice story. It's a myth. You look at the stones themselves and they would be limited in what they would be able to communicate, but you marry these two together and then suddenly the message of these stones becomes very rich and vivid and exciting.
Right. Yeah. It's a symbiotic relationship. The stones, the ostraca and the seals and the walls, as you said, I mean, they can tell you a little bit, but to really understand the people who built the walls and why they built the walls and the threats they were facing and even, you know, what, you know, their diet and their interactions with one another, walls don't really give you too much insight into any of that. But the historical record does, the Bible does. The Bible is incredibly detailed. So if you take that tangible evidence and then you put it beside and read it along with the biblical text, you can just have a much more sophisticated understanding of what happened. And that was what Dr. Mazar was just, first of all, willing to do and then really brilliant at doing. And that's what a lot of archaeologists don't do because they don't want to use the Bible in that way. Their understandings are just really limited. They're limited because there's this whole dimension that they're not using.
I find it refreshing a lot of times reading the archaeological articles on Watch Jerusalem and in the magazine on the website, where you'll have someone who uncovers something and they'll say, well, this is clearly contradictory to the Bible account. And our writers will look a little deeper and study into that biblical account and say, well, there's, you know, you can absolutely account for what you're seeing in those stones. If you look at the bigger picture of what's going on here, it might be different than what you expect if you're just looking at a surface account, you know, or you don't really know the Bible.
Yeah.
But there's just a lot of rich detail in there that only is teased out with that deeper, richer study.
Right. It happens, I wanted to say all the time, but it happens at least regularly. One example comes to mind. You know, archaeologists have found pagan idols in Judah, in Jerusalem, and all around Judah. They've found pagan idols, and they've found that idols existed in one period, but not another period. So they'll look at the Bible and they say, well, the Bible says ancient Israel didn't have idols. But we've actually found idols, therefore the Bible must be wrong because it says the Jews didn't have idols. It was against God's law. Well, it was against God's law, but the Bible actually says that the Jews absolutely had idols. They practiced idol worship under some of their evil kings. So they're proving the Bible, not disproving it. And then the Bible also shows that under righteous kings put a stop to idol worship and really just purge the land of idols, which would explain why during some period they just haven't found idols.
Yeah. You mentioned that we'll actually be sponsoring digs over there. This is something that, you know, a lot of people are excited about. I know Dr. Mazar really did want to resume digging and there were a lot of obstacles in the way. Can you give us any sense of where we are with actually being able to get back into digging?
Sure. Well, we're very, very close. In a COVID world, you never quite know how close or far away you are. Traveling to Israel is complicated. I think very soon, over the next month to 4 or 5 months, depending on how everything goes, I think we're going to be digging again on the Ophel. So we're going to be digging in King Solomon's period there on the Ophel. So a couple hundred feet up the hill from the city of David. So you know, there's still some details to be figured out, but we've been working with authorities in Jerusalem. We've been working with Hebrew University, and everyone's very positive that we'll be able to start digging between now and early summer. Mm. It's very exciting.
Fantastic. Well, we've been talking with Brad McDonald, the assistant director of the new Armstrong Mazar Institute of Biblical Archaeology. They just sent the first issue of the magazine for the Institute off to press yesterday, Let the Stones Speak. And as Mr. McDonald said, the website of the Institute should launch next week, armstrongmazar.com. So these are exciting days for this new effort to promote biblical archaeology. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
My pleasure.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A lot of European nations have fairly weak leaders these days, leaders who try to govern by consensus. This is not the case in Hungary. A man who is cast in the traditional mold of a strong man leads that nation, and this coming year he could grow even stronger, as we will now hear in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
Last month, Angela Merkel stepped down as Chancellor of Germany. Leading in Berlin for over 16 years, she's presided over the European Union's largest economy and largest population. She's been called the Union's unofficial leader and the uncrowned Queen of Europe. Her successor as Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, is still new to the job and doesn't have the same levels of support that Merkel had. This means that, in Europe, there's a sense among many that Merkel's vacant throne is now up for grabs. But who will replace her? Some in the media have implied that people like French President Emmanuel Macron or Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi are men to watch. But to the east of them, there's another European leader sensing opportunity to boost his power. He is Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. To many in the EU, Viktor Orban is a pest that won't go away. Between his attacks on free media, his controversial refugee policies, and his squabbles in the European Parliament, Orban has a habit of getting on Brussels' nerves. But he is also an isolated pest. Hungary is a small country with a small population, a small economy, and a small military. The amount of influence Orban has over the rest of Europe is limited. But last month, the Hungarian strongman gave a few signs that he's ready for the counterattack, and he's prepared to punch above his weight. First, there is his response to the new German government. On December 8th, Olaf Scholz was inaugurated as Germany's new chancellor. 2 days before that, Orban published an online essay on Hungarian-German relations. In the essay, Orban described Merkel and him as partners in the fight, a team keeping Europe afloat through its various crises. But he called the 2015 Syrian refugee crisis, when Merkel opened the floodgates for the mass migration of Middle Eastern refugees, a rupture between Berlin and Budapest. Orban accused Merkel of unraveling the fabric of European unity. With Scholz replacing Merkel, Orban ended his essay with this, quote, "One thing is for sure. The era of ambiguity, stealth politics, and drifting has ended with Merkel. The gloves are now off as we enter a new age," unquote. Olaf Scholz is not Angela Merkel. He is still new to the job and doesn't nearly have the same kind of charisma Merkel had to keep the country together. He's only in power because of a shaky coalition agreement between two other parties. Scholz would be an easier man for Orban to pick a fight with. And the essay suggests that Orban is ready to pick a fight with him. Not too long after he published the essay, Orban showed what kind of punches he's willing to give now that the gloves are off. One of Europe's latest crises is a flare-up in the Balkans. Since last October, Bosnian Serb leader Milorad Dodik has threatened to have Bosnian Serb lands secede from Bosnia-Herzegovina. This would most likely send the region back into a bloody ethnic civil war, like it had in the 1990s. Russian President Vladimir Putin has been prodding Dodik on, though how much Putin actually supports him is questionable. Putin isn't Dodik's only friend, however. Orban is also supporting him. But Putin supports Dodik, among other reasons, to stop Bosnia-Herzegovina from joining the EU. Orban, meanwhile, is supporting Dodik from inside the EU. Late last month, he gave Republika Srpska, Bosnia-Herzegovina's autonomous Serb entity, 100 million euros, that's over 113 million US dollars. Hungarian Foreign Minister Péter Szijjártó also threatened to veto European sanctions on Dodik. Orban claims that attacking Dodik would harm Bosnia-Herzegovina's integration into the EU. But how policies that potentially lead to ethnic civil war help European integration isn't clear. Some see Orban's support for Dodik as a direct challenge to Germany. Szijjártó gave his ultimatum 5 days after new German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock called for sanctions against Dodik. Balkan Insight wrote on December 21st that, quote, "The move is seen as a direct challenge to the new German government, which wants to abolish the requirement for unanimity in EU foreign policy decisions," unquote. This could be Orban's way of stating that it is Budapest, not Berlin, that determines how things are run in Eastern Europe. Hungary faces parliamentary elections in the spring. The opposition is so desperate to unseat Orban that every opposition party, from the Greens to the far right, has entered a political alliance to compete against him as a united front. If the opposition loses, and Orban's Fidesz party is currently leading in polls, Orban's hold on power will be stronger than ever, and he'll be in a better position to increase that hold even more. Sensing weakness in Berlin, Orban may be positioning himself as the EU's Eastern Mr. Europe. Either way, even amidst pressure from Brussels, Viktor Orban's Hungary is becoming more and more influential. This is despite Hungary's small size, population, economy, and military. One may wonder what the end result of Orban's power playing will be. The Trumpet has long been interested in the rise of European strongmen. We base our analysis on biblical prophecies like Revelation chapter 17. Revelation 17 verse 3 portrays a seven-headed beast, a biblical symbol for an empire. Other prophecies, like those found in Revelation chapter 13 and Daniel chapter 7, show this to be the Roman Empire. Revelation 17 verse 10 brings out that the seven heads represent seven consecutive kings, or resurrections of that empire, to occur throughout history. Six of those resurrections have come and gone, the last of them being Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. That means there is one more yet to come. This last one will be a union of 10 different European countries under 10 different strongmen. These 10 so-called kings are prophesied to be around at Christ's second coming, a yet future event. You could read that in Revelation 17, verses 12 and 14. We expect Hungary to be one of those 10 countries. Hungary was an ally of Hitler's in World War II. Before that, it was an integral part of the Habsburg Empire, another one of those resurrections. And under Orban, Hungary has slid more and more away from democracy and more towards dictatorship. Viktor Orban is not the man we expect to take the reins of all of Europe. He is not Angela Merkel's replacement as the leader of the EU. However, increasingly, he looks like he'll become Hungary's king. We wrote the following in an article for the Philadelphia Trumpet's January 2018 print edition. Quote, European Union bureaucrats are struggling to deal with a new type of leader. He is not sophisticated, multicultural, and managerial. He is not soft, consensus building, and wary of giving offense. He is strong. He is patriotic. He is decisive. He is everything the European Commission in Brussels is not. European bureaucrats hate him. Yet this type of leader is emerging in country after country. Whether bureaucrats like it or not, these strongmen are Europe's future. Unquote. Viktor Orban is one of these strongmen. He's one of the most established and influential of these strongmen. And he and leaders like him are increasingly becoming Europe's future. To learn more, please read our article, Introducing Europe's Eastern Strongmen. Also, please request a free copy of Who or What is the Prophetic Beast by Herbert W. Armstrong to learn more about Revelation chapter 17 and what the prophecies there mean for Europe. You can find both at thetrumpet.com.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. What has Viktor Orban done to make the rest of Europe hate him?
Well, here's the thing. You hear a lot of people, especially on the left of the spectrum, call him a dictator, how he's backsliding from democratic values. When studying a figure like Viktor Orban, it's important to filter what is based off of people's viewpoints and what he's actually doing on the ground. Like, for example, one of the big things that a lot of people have against him is that whereas a lot of leaders, like I mentioned in the program with Angela Merkel, they were inviting refugees to come in during the height of the Syrian crisis, he was building border walls. And a lot of people criticized him for that, saying that, like, this is a humanitarian catastrophe and what he's doing. I mean, it's his country, sovereign, having control of your own borders and is one of the big aspects of sovereignty. So in that sense, you can't really fault him for that. But it's interesting because he's standing up to a lot of things like protecting borders or marginalizing the LGBT people, for example. It's another thing that a lot of people on the left, which and Brussels is full of those kinds of people, go after him for. He's actually attracting a lot of attention from American conservatives who sort of see him as like a kindred spirit almost with their fight with the political left in Washington. United States President Donald Trump last year actually praised Viktor Orban in a letter he sent last August. And Fox News' Tucker Carlson even visited him and gave a very extensive interview with the Hungarian leader, talking with a very positive focus on the interview rather than roasting him per se. He tried to paint Orban in the most positive light, which with some of the stuff that some of the other things that he's done, as well as some of the things I mentioned in my segment, shows that this might be dangerous thinking and that he's not the good liberal Democrat that a lot of people might think he is.
Well, as much support as he may be gaining from some conservatives in the United States, he certainly has support of a lot of people within his own country. And I would imagine that you have segments of the electorate of many other European nations who are looking to the way that he is leading as being a real viable alternative to some of the weakness that you see in a lot of the other countries in Europe. Now, we talk about this prophecy of 10 kings in Europe. This is a man who's acting like a king. And I think of the kind of leftist policies that you see in some European countries as being kind of a relic of a past Europe when you look at it prophetically, that it's almost like what Orban represents is more of what we can expect to see growing more in European nations. The question I'd like to ask you, I think this is just interesting to consider. How do you see his strongman tendencies, his Hungary first type of policies gel with this idea of this prophecy of these 10 kings coming together and pooling their strength behind a single European strongman?
That's a little bit of a dichotomy, like thinking about how could somebody be Hungary first or like supporting your country first and at the same time pooling together all these different together with all these different countries to form a super state when that's what people like Orban are claim to be rallying against. Well, of course, it has to be remembered at this time the super state is controlled by the what we would call the left, like the Nordic model, Scandinavian, multilateral people. It's not a coincidence that most of the politicians, well, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of the prominent politicians from in Brussels come from places like the Benelux countries, Scandinavia, all these countries that have a history with this kind of way of thinking. And that doesn't exactly mesh in a lot of countries like in Eastern Europe. But time and time again, what's shown to really unite different peoples in Europe is, well, a couple of things. One of the main ones being a crisis. When there's an existential crisis happening, and a lot of countries that normally would be looking out on their own interests see that the only way to preserve their own interests is to pool together, and especially if they have a common worldview. That's what you saw in World War II with Hitler and Mussolini and a lot of smaller rightist countries like Hungary or some other ones, Romania, Bulgaria, to a lesser degree, Spain. They saw themselves as being, especially the Eastern ones, as facing a communist threat in the sense of Russia and seeing, okay, well, we're all right-thinking governments. It's better for us to pool together and face off this communist threat rather than to squabble with each other. And, of course, Hitler took advantage of that, and the unity didn't last long, per se. But there's a lot of different – the reason – far-right groups and people like Orban are so popular in Europe is because so many Europeans in different parts of Europe can feel like tension in the air, that there's a crisis happening. Mm-hmm. And the old-school liberal elites, Nordic model, they're more concerned about preserving the status quo when the status quo is clearly failing them. Like, for example, the refugee policy. Europe experienced a whole lot of terror attacks, and especially in the countries like Germany that accepted most of the refugees, a lot of the common people are thinking, well, you know, liberal ideas aside, common sense will tell us we don't want these people coming into our countries. Or other things like, for example, Brexit. Britain splitting off from the union shows just how fragile the union is. And a lot of rightists actually supported Brexit. But a lot of other people are seeing, okay, this all of a sudden we thought Britain was our friend. Now we can't really work with Britain in the EU anymore. Like the Czech Republic, for example, the right party there was a big ally with the conservatives there. And now they're nervous. How are we going to work together? Or how are we going to work in Brussels without a strong partner? And so big crises like this are causing rightists to look to each other to help each other out.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see what develops. It does seem like Orban could very well be one of those 10 prophesied kings. We've been talking with trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic about Hungarian strongman Viktor Orban. He's written an article at thetrumpet.com. Will 2022 be Viktor Orban's year? Go check it out. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
COVID has destroyed businesses and disrupted lives. And as governments have scrambled to provide financial relief, criminals have taken advantage, as we will now hear in this report from Rufaro Manyepa.
The Secret Service announced on December 21st that criminals have stolen nearly $100 billion in COVID-19 relief funds. Not a lot of people know this, but the Presidential Protection Service also functions as the lead investigator of financial fraud. So far, it's arrested over 100 criminals and recovered about $2.3 billion in stolen funds. And the perpetrators of these crimes range from individuals to organized groups, but there's still over 900 active investigations, with cases in every single state in the union. Much of this theft that's happened has come from fraudulent claims. One Oregon dentist has been charged with stealing $8 million in relief. That's just one person. This was after he allegedly successfully applied for and received loans meant for struggling restaurants by himself claiming that he owned three restaurants in Florida. In a separate issue, one man in Florida received $2.1 million in fraudulent Paycheck Protection Program loans, and he spent most of the money that he stole on a new Lamborghini, on Rolex watches, on designer clothes from Louis Vuitton and other brands. In the state of Michigan, the state itself paid over $8.5 billion in fraudulent jobless claims throughout the course of the pandemic. And this was despite them not paying a further $43 billion in fraudulent claims. And this same situation has been replicated across states all over the country. Part of the reason for this is just the sheer size of the COVID-19 relief pot. It was $5.3 trillion in size. So that means that the amount that's actually been stolen is only 3% of the total available funds. One special agent from the Secret Service says that it was the size and easy accessibility of the pot that made theft nearly irresistible for criminals. Here's what he said. He said, "There's no doubt that the programs were easily accessible online, and so with that comes the opportunity for bad actors to get into the mix. I've been in law enforcement for over 29 years and worked some complex fraud investigation for 20 plus years, and I've never seen something at this scale," he said. Now, all of this is the result of living in a society that justifies stealing at a self-checkout. It's the result of living in a country where broke states justify stealing housing aid to finance unsustainable government programs. It's the result of living in a country where political elites are willing to subvert the will of the people and steal an election. Hear this telling statement from that special agent I quoted earlier. He said, "Can we stop fraud? Will we? No. But I think we can definitely prosecute those that need to be prosecuted, etc., etc." We live in a society based on greed and deceit, one that disregards morality and law in favor of pleasure and self-gratification. While there are laws that Secret Service agents work hard to enforce, they aren't effective because people refuse to embrace the spiritual laws codified in the Bible. Some of our listeners might believe that societal conditions don't have anything to do with our moral condition or the Bible, but the reality is that American foreign policy is in shambles. The stratospheric national debt has been ignored for decades, and now certain goods and groceries are either unavailable or nearly twice as expensive as they were a year ago. These are the worrying effects of something, and for every effect, there is a cause. The Bible spells out that broken laws are the cause. America's loss of prestige and influence is a direct result of increasing moral decadence. In Hosea 4, God warns the nation of Israel that he has a controversy or a legal case against them. Verses 1 and 2 say that this is because there is no truth, no mercy, no knowledge of God in the land, that there is killing, lying, and stealing. Herbert W. Armstrong proved in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that America and Britain descended from ancient Israel. So these prophecies are chiefly about modern-day America and Britain. Despite having a special relationship with God based on his law, these nations have repeatedly broken God's law throughout their history. This theft of $100 billion is just a drop in the bucket of all the disobedience that's been taking place. And as a result, there are curses upon these nations. But while God promises curses for disobedience, he also promises blessings for obedience. Society today is based on the way of Get, but the blessings outlined in the Bible are a result of living the way of Give. They come from obedience to God's law, which is built on the principle of complete selflessness. That is what God expects from the people he has a relationship with. Request your free copy of The United States and Britain in Prophecy to learn more about this special relationship.
It's time for today's last word.
Think about the people you consider your closest friends. What is the quality of those friendships? How do you deal with differences of opinion? Do your friends listen to you and treat your thoughts and opinions with respect? Are you able to share your heart with them, your innermost thoughts and feelings? Can you rely on them for help when you need it? Do your friends respect the things you tell them in confidence? Can you trust them? Are you honest with each other? Does your friend help you recognize your personal faults when he or she feels you need it? And if you pointed out a problem to your friend, would he or she accept that? Do your friends help you to become a better person? Do you feel like they're behind you when you try to improve your life? And how would the people you consider your closest friends answer those questions about you? What sort of quality friend are you? We all need friends. God created us to be social beings. He says it's not good for a man to be alone. We need to feel understood by other people. We need to be able to share ourselves openly with others. What can you do to increase your bond of friendship with those around you? And how can you make your closest friendships even better? I'll give you two qualities you can strive to cultivate in your friendships. And this includes your marriage. Our mate should be our closest friend. I'll give you two qualities today, and next week I'll give you a few more. We'll start by talking about acceptance. All your friends are sinners, and so are you. The question is, how good are you at loving people despite their faults? Of course, we shouldn't compromise with God's law or tolerate lawlessness. We should hate sin, but we must also be very skilled at loving sinners. If you think deep down that you're better than another person, whether you realize it or not, that will show in your actions. Vanity and self-righteousness are great barriers to true friendship. You'll never give much of yourself to a person you look down on. Think about the fact that God called Abraham his friend. You can read about that in James 2 and verse 23. Exodus 33 says, God spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. How big of a gulf was there between God and those men in terms of righteousness, spiritual maturity, intellect, and so many other areas? Yet God didn't consider himself above those men in that sense. Jesus Christ was perfect, but he didn't go around condemning people all the time. He was accused of being a friend of tax collectors and sinners. The bond of brotherly love with another person will grow if you get rid of vanity and you base that relationship on mutual humility and respect. Accepting your friends means listening to them, giving them sincere compliments. Accepting them means seeing the positive big picture, not letting a mistake get in the way. Being a true friend means not being negative and critical of the other person. Unless you handle criticism carefully, it never gets good results. It really just creates bad feelings and sore spots. Albert Hubbard said, "Your friend is the man who knows all about you and still likes you." James Boswell said, "A companion loves some agreeable qualities which a man may possess, but a friend loves the man himself." Another important quality to cultivate is encouragement. True friends don't feel threatened by each other's achievements. They're not in competition with one another trying to be the one on top. They genuinely desire each other's success. They want for each to reach his or her full potential. Being a friend means giving the other person room to change and grow, wanting him or her to become a better person. And even more, it means helping your friend grow. Friends help each other overcome and solve problems. A tremendous biblical example of friendship is that of Jonathan and David. Jonathan was the son of King Saul. He was 20 years older than David. He'd been married. He'd raised children. He had considerable accomplishments in his life. When David came along and it became clear that God had selected him to be the next king of Israel, Jonathan realized he'd been passed over for the kingship. But rather than feeling threatened, it says in 1 Samuel 18, the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. When Jonathan realized David had been selected as king, he was the first to congratulate him, and he promised to back David all the way. Now, on the other hand, when Saul realized that his kingship was going to be passed on to David, he became so jealous he sought to kill David. When you see a close friend succeed, do you act like Jonathan or Saul? True friendships really benefit from this kind of encouragement. Love your friends for who they are and encourage them to help them grow and become better. Those are two ways you can deepen your friendships. And we'll talk about a few more ways in next week's Last Word. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brad McDonald, Mihailo Zekic, and Rufaro Manyepa. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Leo Buscaglia. The fact that I can plant a seed and it becomes a flower, share a bit of knowledge and it becomes another's, smile at someone and receive a smile in return, are to me continual spiritual exercises. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.